Hola, hello, hi, bienvenido, and welcome back, or welcome to Mentors Today. Super excited to be here today with a good old but young friend that I've had the good pleasure to know for quite a number of years now, it seems. Time flies. So we're joined by Jean-Michel Abeneza, the founder of I Debate Rwanda. Jean-Michel is deeply committed to empowering youth and cultivating peace through conversation and debate. He's had a heart for peace and communication since his younger days. He co-founded, way back when, an organization called Peace and Love Proclaimers, which was Youth for a Change back in 2007, through which he pioneered initiatives that promoted unity in Rwanda's post-genocidal generation. His impactful leadership expanded with his founding of I Debate Rwanda, where he has enabled over 5,000 students across 115, I think he just told me before the show it's up to like 150 now, schools, to master civil discourse and securing prestigious victories in the 2017 African Debate Championship in the esteemed Rollins Cup. He's an advocate for global change. He's been a TEDx speaker, and he's had engagements with over 60 U.S. universities that echo his dedication to civil discourse and societal transformation. He's got a master's in social entrepreneurship and change from Pepperdine University here in the Los Angeles area, which is how we met. And he's got a bachelor's in international relations from Towson University, back there in the East Coast. Jean-Michel's work spans publications like the Foreign Policy Journal and the Huffington Post. His commitment to preventing both atrocities and fostering societal change is exemplified in the co-founding of his internationally recognized Walk to Remember. And his vision continues through I Debate Rwanda, where he has this crazy aspiration to eventually serve 1,000 schools by the 2030. And in a world today where we have ever-increasing tensions and where we have ever-increasing conflict amongst peoples and amongst religions and amongst sects of societies, I just thought it was a timely time to bring my friend Jean-Michel to talk about the world that he sees through his eyes, which I've been enamored of since the very first time I met him. So Jean-Michel, welcome, buddy.
Hey, Rob. Thank you so much for inviting me. I feel very privileged to be here and have a conversation with you.
It's been a while. It's good to catch up. We have many mutual friends connection through our time serving the social entrepreneurship programs at Pepperdine, through our very, very best friend, Steve Kernan. Mm-hmm. Dr. Kernan, we couldn't have this conversation today without giving him a shout out. So I'm sure he'll enjoy listening to this as much as I will. And as much as I'm sure you will, sharing your story to yet another audience who maybe has never thought about these things the way that you do.
No, definitely. And when you invited me, I felt, first of all, I felt a lot of pressure because of the amount of respect that I have for you. But then also I knew that it would just be a conversation, which we have had many.
Exactly. So let's do this. Let's jump into it. I know your personal story, but I want everybody else to understand kind of the real, as we always say when I talk to entrepreneurs or storytellers, you know, why you and why this? Right? Why you and why are you working on this? Why has this thing, I Debate Rwanda, and this whole concept become essentially not just a business, an organization, but it's become your life's work?
Yeah. I think that it will be hard for me to talk about the work that we're doing without the context from which we were functioning. You know, at heart, I think of myself as a peace builder. I think of myself as somebody who is sort of trying to answer the question. And I always say that my life biggest question is, how do we live together? And how do we, and we being those who are born after such an atrocity. So, you know, I'm originally from Rwanda. I grew up in Rwanda. And for many people, they know Rwanda as a place where about 30 years ago, a genocide happened, where in a space of 100 days, 1 million people were massacred. And Rwanda is a small country. I mean, it's the size of Maryland. And at that point, it was almost, you know, for many Americans, when they think of atrocities, maybe many can think of 9/11. But in Rwanda, it was 3 9/11 every day for 100 days.
That's insane.
You know, that's the magnitude of that. And one of the things that happens after a tragedy such as, you know, the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda, is, you know, the question is, how do you rebuild? How does a society come back and live together? And I think that a lot of work was done by the government to ensure that, you know, there's security. There was a lot of work to ensure that there's, you know, rule of law and that all the killings were stopped and that the country was rebuilding. I mean, right after the genocide, there was a spike, or there was almost like a transformation of our economy. There was a transformation of the society as a whole. But one of the things that, that you start noticing when the genocide happened, I was just about 5 or 6 years old. So it means that I was very young during the genocide. But as you grow, you start noticing that the generation that comes after every tragedy is sort of like the definite generation that can either take back the community to what has happened before, or we can really set our society into a new role or into a new place. And one of the things that I thought for me was, you know, you start seeing all these things and you start learning about the division. And one of the things is how polarized the society becomes. One of my friends normally said that polarization is both a cause and an effect of conflict. So you find that as people are becoming more polarized, then it becomes easier to commit crimes against one another and things like that. So when I was younger, right after my high school, actually in my last semester in high school, I with a few friends started an organization called Peace and Love Proclaimers. And the idea was, what if we, you know, that the hopefulness of youth, right? Like you, like when I think through now, I'm like, if anyone asked us what we're like, we had no idea what we were doing, but there was this passion about wanting to make a difference. There was this passion about what if we made never again, really never again? What if we built a new generation and new things? And when I think of it now, I'm like, we were bold. We were like,
also you kind of don't know in youthfulness of our teenage years, right? We don't know what we don't know.
Exactly.
And therefore we don't know that we can fail or embarrass ourselves.
And to be honest, for me, what ended up happening is when I reflect back, is something in my mind changed. There was this understanding that things can happen if you care enough about it and that you're willing to really put your full self to it. Because we were making things happen with no money. We were not accepting no's. We were moving. We're greedy. And it, for me, I was 19 years old, and you're leading an organization that has thousands of people who are close to your age. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to give them a vision, tell them, you know, this is what we should be doing. And it freaked me out. You know, it's like, how am I going to do this? You know? But luckily there was just a big group of us who were very passionate, and we started building. And, you know, as I grew, I grew a bit older. I was given a chance to come to Towson, that's in Maryland, and on a debate scholarship. I just fell on it. I was like, well, that sounds like a fun thing. And when I came here, debate was another thing. Like, it was this thing where our team was known as the team that would bring to the round. So debate, think about it. Debate was created most of the time for people who are going to go to law school, who are practicing.
Okay. I was going to say, let's back up a second and like kind of explain debate as a competition. Like, let's describe that for people who might not know.
Oh, yes. So the way it works, it's almost, to be honest, I thought it's almost like athletics. Right. So you're part of the debate team. You go to tournaments every 2 weeks. You are competing. Many universities meet. There's a championship, and then, you know, the winners. There are many rounds. You face off another team, and you only win. Maybe you're remaining a winner for 1 week, because then the next weekend there's another tournament. To be honest with you, Rob, one of the things that I was confused about, I mean, think of it, you know, I'm a kid, first time in the U.S. and, you know, the first weekend I'm going to a debate tournament, and I see how hard these people are working, and I'm like, why? Like, what are you gaining? Like, you know, it's, are you,
right?
You know, like, I was like, Americans are very competitive. I'm like,
yeah, I was going to say, you got dropped right into like that Americanized sports gamified culture.
Exactly. And this thing where I was confused, because I thought maybe there's something else to win, except this trophy that you can get at $20, right? It's like, something else. But I loved it, though. I loved it because there was just this amount of research, amount of that, you know, we were doing. And our team was very famous because there's the national debate circuit, and our team was the first African-American team to win But the thing is that they were using debate as a vehicle to talk about things that people don't want to talk about. So they used to bring in a lot of debates about, you know, structural racism, about white supremacy, about social justice. So a lot of, they would use that as a conduit for them to engage in conversations that are important.
And did that, at that time, again, being an immigrant student in the US, it's all new. The whole debate experience is new to you. Even then, at those early days, is it starting to like plant a seed in your head where you're thinking back home?
I got to the US in, I think, 19th of August, 2008. And I found an email I sent to my father on the 15th of September, 2008.
And I... Six weeks later.
Yeah, I said, I want to build something similar in Rwanda. And it's so crazy how vision works, because I looked at, I got, fell on my email and I said, I literally put a blueprint of all the things that I wanted to do.
Wow. Like,
we're going to have a league every year where we talk about things that are important. We're going to have summer programs where we train kids on how to take whatever they're learning in debate and apply it to the real world.
Wow.
And that we are going to be, and when I look at that, I'm like, that is crazy.
Right, because you're 20-ish years old.
Yeah, no, I was 20 years old.
I mean, and again, could have had every reason in the world to be overwhelmed by just the experiences you were going through in your own life, selfishly. Like, that would have been totally acceptable, right? And yet, it sparked it. I'm fascinated. I want to go back a little bit. I'm fascinated by a couple things you've said. I scribbled down. And this last one is, so it was part the debate experience that catalyzed you, but it was really that these people that you were now surrounded by were using debate as a tool to talk about things that even you, as a non-American citizen at the time, already understood, like, oh, wait a minute, we're talking about things that they don't talk about here. So if this is true here, maybe I could get us to talk about the things that we don't talk about back home.
It was exactly that, because it flipped something in my mind. It was like, well, this could be amazing, because there is that element of competition, of course. And, you know, I think competition is good. But then it was also this element of using that as a training ground for this new generation, because things that we are talking about are not just things that are tied to emotions, right? It's not just like it's really hard subjects. It's really hard things and complicated issues and complex matters. And then that this could be a training ground for us to be able to do that. And one of the things that I found really important was there needed to be two things that I found important, because, and the reason I'm saying it's important is because sometimes we remove it, is one of them was that element of competition, that element of really using this as doing research and going really, really hard. But then also the second element, which I think maybe I feel like in iDebate we're doing better than some of the American programs, is that it has to have a societal significance.
Yeah.
It's not just about this Eiffel Tower philosophizing about life. No, it needs to be something where we relate it back to life and how this leads to some real world impact. It needs to be something where we're really being trained on how to deal with the world as it is, and then we figure out what, you know, we can do to move it forward.
You said something interesting in passing in the early part of your opening statement, which was this idea that, if I caught it, was like I run into these debaters, and I'm thinking, well, this is just what like the kids who want to go to law school use, or right, they're preparing to be. So part of it, what you just said, it sounds like in the normal construct of debate as a tool inside of a single university community, it's really still being utilized as like an individual skill development experience, right? And so you were looking at it more broadly and you thought, okay, I see the individual skill development aspect of this, that's obvious. And I see the gamified competitive aspect, kind of the organizing principle behind it, that makes sense. But if I could take that and then I could use this to broaden out the effect, like to have these ripples go. So again, you took that. You said, I'm going to go back to Rwanda, and it's not going to be about a single university or a single school, and not just about the development of those individuals, but the development of those individuals as a generation of leaders And then this goes back to the thing I wanted to ask you about again from your opening comments. I heard my words, but your phraseology, you were essentially born into kind of like this generation recovery.
Yeah.
Like you were the recovery generation, like in your life in Rwanda. And so you, as you said, you were either going to be the recovery generation that was gonna try and make things better and go forward, or you were gonna be a generation that essentially just tried to like be reborn and then just recapture the old world. Right. And so it sounds like you and your friends with your first initiatives, and then it is carried forward through your experiences to today. It was always about like you wanted to recover and be better.
And forward looking, right? It's part of it is looking at, okay, none of us are responsible for what happened, right? We were too young or not even born. But then now it's almost one has to take responsibility and say, okay, what do we do with what we can? You know, one of the things that I found a lot in societies of very smart people, right, is this very cynicism, you know, pessimism that is hidden behind well-articulated arguments, right? It's like, yeah, we can tell you 10,000 reasons to why we think that is not the best course. But I'm like, well, at the end of it, it's like, we need to lead and we need to do whatever we can with what we have, and it's imperfect.
Right. No, because I mean, at 19, 20, 22, you know, you're one could argue on a societal level, we still don't hold much power, right? We hold the power of us as individuals. Mm-hmm. And then obviously collectively that amplifies the power, but we still structurally, we don't tend to hold much real power, right? That still sits in the hands of, at that time, gentlemen like your father or that generation, right? And so you're kind of stuck in that, like, well, wait a minute, it's going to be up to us to build a better Rwanda, but we're not the ones in charge of the governmental bodies or the banks or the reconstruction and we're not in charge of the churches. But then, to your point, you could either sit back and just accept that and say, well, it's their fault. They were alive during this. They did this, so they've got to fix it. Or you could just lean into fixing it.
Yeah, and I'll give you maybe just as an illustration of that. One of my mentors told me once, I was frustrated. I was like, oh, I'm just going to leave all of the things. It's a lot to think of it. It's a lot of my friends used to say, you just like hard life. Like life could be simpler. You know what I mean? Life could be simpler. But you know, one of the things that my mentor told me, he gave me an illustration of Ronaldo. He says, Ronaldo gets in a football stadium. In a football stadium, there is, you know, a lot of people sitting in the crowd. And then he says, and then there are about 22 players on the field. And then he says, who do you think has the most advice? Who's speaking the loudest? Who's making a lot of noise? It's the people that are up in the stadium. Those are the ones making noise. But then he says, but the guys who are in the field, there is a chance that they might get their leg broken. There's a chance that they might have an injury that will cause them to die or, you know, just be impaired. But the reason to why they go on the field is they know that there's a chance that magic can happen. He told me, he's like, you have to live as if magic can happen. He said, you'll be bruised, you'll be tired, you'll be overworked, but that is far better than those who are seated up in the stadium.
100% true. That was a wise man. Okay, let's do this before we dig in too much deeper into some of the philosophy of buying the hiss. Let's give everybody a picture. So, I Debate Rwanda is your organization. It is rooted in Rwanda, but let's just do me the like entrepreneur founder snapshot. Like, this is how long the program's been around. This is how many people we serve. This is how many. This is where we're growing. Give me all that.
So iDebates is a debate program, that an after-school program that works with middle school and high school students. I say that we teach them two crucial skills, communication skills and critical thinking, which I think are very important for the 21st century. And we do it three ways. One, we have student training. So our students go through training from the basics of public speaking to complex argumentation and research. And then we have student competition, where every 2 weeks or so, they're having competitions either in school or with other schools. And then we have also teacher training. And that is to work with the teachers so that they build their support for the students, but then also so they also build a more democratic classroom. So currently we work with 150 schools, and that's close to 8,000 students.
Wow.
And part of, but we've been doing it for 11 years. And one of the things I like to say is that for 8 years, we were working with just 30 schools. And then after that, I think we started figuring out what works. And then now we're, you know, more in the, a lot of growth. But as part of our program, we also, I always say that we are not trying to build the best debaters. We always say that we are trying to use this as a training ground for leaders. So, for example, every student throughout the year, they have the same theme. And we take our themes from the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals of the UN. And the reason is that's where all the world is heading to, right? It's everything is SDG. So about two years ago, we talked about, you know, quality education, SDG 4. Last year, we talked about climate action, SDG 13. This year, we're talking about SDG 1, no poverty. And what that means, just to tell you, to give you an illustration, is in the first semester, we are debating about causes of poverty. So, for example, are we, is the cause of poverty, there are many people. Some would say is lack of access to education. Some other people will talk about, you know, colonialism and its impact. And some others will talk about, you know, neo-colonialism. So there's a lot of these things that we really dig to and look at what are the causes of poverty. The second one is to look at what are the solutions. And there we're looking at microloans, we're looking at entrepreneurship, social entrepreneurship, businesses, capitalism, state-run capitalism. So a lot of those concepts, students would then get to debate about it. And then the last semester is really to look at government policies and that are put in place. So at the end of it, we want the students to have a deep understanding of what of the issues, and then hopefully, you know, equipping them that now they can become leaders in their own schools. One of the things that we also do is we give students money to organize their own events on campus, on their own campuses, in their own communities. So we say, you know, you're learning all of these things. How does that look like on your campus? So,
because while there are some standards, the truth is one campus in one far part of the country might be different than, obviously will be different. Like there might be more like cultural differences, kind of localized things, et cetera. So and before we skip over it, so you're doing all this impact that you're creating with a team, I think you told me before the show, of about 12-ish. 12 or 13 folks, including yourself, the fearless leader. But there's a network behind that that extends out to these local schools of volunteers. How many volunteers are there or have there been?
Right now, we've just onboarded about 400 volunteers. And again, you know, sometimes, Rob, you just get lucky. You know, I would love to say we thought about it, but it was like we didn't have enough money. And right. We had all these students who had been part of our program who were like, well, what can I do? So we're like, oh, let's formalize this. And we started figuring out, they have, you know, some of them will come for a full year, work with us. And
okay. And this 400 is the current cohort. So over the 11 years, there probably been a few thousand volunteers.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And some geography again. So you told us all, you taught us that Rwanda is essentially geographically the size of the state of Maryland. So give us an idea, 150 different middle schools and high schools, are they spread all over Rwanda? Are there any outside of Rwanda in neighboring states yet?
No. So right now, Rwanda is divided into five, we call them five provinces. So okay. That would be like five states. And in those five, we are fully working in two, and then started doing small programming in two others. And the whole idea is, you know, our scale path is we just go slow. It takes a lot of mindset change. It takes a lot of building relationships. So we take slow. So from the time one province is onboarded to the time it's fully, it takes about 3 years.
Yeah. And so back to we said in your bio, is the aspiration still like to get to 1,000 schools by 2032?
Yes. Yeah.
So again, that's while a huge aspiration in context, it's also, as you said, it's kind of a methodical
Yes.
Right? Like, okay, like if by 2032, you will have been at this for 20 years, roughly, and to get to 1,000 schools all across basically every province.
Yes.
By that point.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that one of the thing that I learned is that it takes about 20 years to have a true impact. And I don't know where I read it, but I just stuck to that. And I was like, well, let's put down a big number that we aspire to. But the whole idea is that at that point, you have changed culture, that it becomes easier then. You know, yeah. The same way I was saying, it took us 8 years working with only 30 schools. And it was harder than working with all the other schools because those you had to convince, and you had no idea what you were doing. So
I'm curious, do kids, young people who have gone through the program, so this would be probably the first generation of kids that went through, and now they've gone to university, or probably by now the earliest kids are even out, maybe a couple are out of university.
Yes.
Have you ever, two questions, I guess, have they ever had any of them come back and work with you guys? Like either work for you or as volunteers? Like are any of your current staffers alumni?
80% of our current
staff that's awesome.
Alumni and 90% of our volunteers alumni.
That's incredible. Because that to me is the proof that...
Exactly.
As they come through this,
yes.
Now fast forward, at the 20-year anniversary, and no matter whether you get to 1,000 schools or some number below that or some number slightly above that, that let's just say is, you know, it sounds like it's roughly 70 to 80, 90 kids per school now. So if that math holds, you literally will have educated and empowered and inspired like 60, 70,000 young people throughout Rwanda, both boys and girls, who will go on and essentially become the generations of leaders in business, entrepreneurs, in finance, in government, in education, in the church. Like they'll
see that's I see a glimpse of that.
Okay. Already.
I'm seeing a glimpse of that already because I honestly feel like the best gift of my life. Because to build an organization is hard. It's tiresome. 90% of it is just frustrations. But last year we celebrated 10 years. And I remember it's the first time I looked and I said, this is so beautiful because number one is what people are seeing now. I saw it when these guys were 10, 15, right? They were,
yeah.
I had already seen this. And not only did I see it, but I invested in them.
Yeah. Now, you saw the 10 or 12 year old.
Yeah.
That was, and you saw this person's going to be a change agent, like this young woman or this young man. And it is, by the way, I keep saying young women and young men. It is both boys and girls, right?
Yes. No. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Of course. Obviously.
One of the things, for example, I'll give you a simple example. This, we had a holiday camp and we had 900 kids for, you know, who came at the camp and we were working with 132 volunteers that were running everything. That camp was run by five young people that had, on average, 20 years old. They were running, and we were talking about a residential camp. And I remember one of the nights, I remember I told them, I was like, nothing gives my life so more meaning than the fact that I look at all of you and I know I've trained all of you. And it's weird because you see them train and you're like, you sound like me. You know, it's like you sound very familiar. But I think it's the long term, man. Like the investing in the long term is the doing the dirty work of coaching and teaching and encouraging and sometimes rebuking and bringing them back, you know, believing in people. Like I think I'm in the business of building people.
Oh, you are.
Yeah. And that has been the most frustrating and the most rewarding thing of my life.
Yeah, no, because we're messy as humans, right? But man, we're messy in a beautiful way.
Exactly. We call it a beautiful mess.
Yeah, that is. Yes, 100% true. All right, so this is a near impossible question to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyways, and we'll see how we can do with it. It's like asking a dad or a grandfather for their favorite grandchild, right? But are there one or two stories? And again, we know you love all your kids and you love everybody that you've ever mentored and coached. But are there one or two stories of a young man or a young woman that have come through the program that you could share that will illustrate, as you like to say, that will illustrate the effect of this for us as well as maybe inspire some of our listeners?
Let me give you two, one that is local in Rwanda and one that was international. And the local one, there's a school in Rwanda called Agahozo Shalom. They normally take the kids, you know, orphan kids who, honestly, they go for the kids who are really, really marginalized. And okay. They get them on, they get an education for 3 or 4 years. And I was hired to work with them. And one of the things you have to imagine, I mean, these are kids who feel like even the fact that you're working with them, it's almost like they don't deserve it.
Yeah, no, they believe they've been left out, left off by society. Yeah.
So one of the times I remember when they would lose, it wasn't just that losing that comes with, oh, maybe we could have done this. It was, you know, I remember one time they lost and one of them came and said, but you know, Jean-Michel, that's just, one of them was called Biko. And he came and he says, you know, they are not smarter than us, but life has been unfair to us. And that's the only reason we're losing. And I remember it broke my heart. It broke my heart. And I remember they were always on time for training. They would always come. And I remember I had this moment where I stopped whatever I had planned. And I spent almost 2 hours talking to them about failure, about how to embrace failure and to tell them that they're as important as anyone else and that they need to believe that. And that I will give everything that I have, everything. If they trust me, I'll give everything and to make sure that they are as good as anyone else. And, you know, it took long. So we took about a year and we had this East African tournament. And in this East African tournament, we have these schools from Uganda, from Kenya who come on. And, you know, I was in the middle running things, running everything. But I didn't notice that these kids got to the finals. And I remember sitting and like, wait, they got to the finals. And I said, I stopped everything. And you got to imagine, you know, it's you're putting off fires and I stopped everything. And I went and I sat down and they had probably one of the best, cleanest win. You know, they won in a way that I remember sitting there looking at them and saying, oh my God.
Even you who had outsized confidence in them, even you were surprised by how well they performed.
No, it's one of those things where you hope they do, but when they do, it blows your mind. And I remember sitting there and I tell them even up to today, the 20th of May, 2015. And I'm like, that day showed me what is possible because they went against the best school in Uganda who are these confident kids, very cocky and all of that. But they gave them such a clean win that it was just amazing to see. And for me that day, it showed me, you know, what is possible. So for example, now the same guy that I'm telling you about, currently he is a policy advisor in the Prime Minister's office in Rwanda. Right?
So
he got a full ride to go to Brown University. And then after that, he decided he wanted to be back because he always wanted to be in policy. So he's now the policy advisor in the Prime Minister's office. Right?
That's awesome.
And that was one of them. The other one is a guy called Mecca. And I don't know if you probably, if you are still working with the Pepperdine Social Entrepreneurship Program. So Mecca came from a village in the north of Rwanda.
Okay.
We usually, kids used to make fun of him that he couldn't speak English. So he came to debate because he wanted to learn how to speak English. And so I took Mecca 2008, came to the U.S., and we went to Rollins College, and it's this very private, you know, in Florida. It's very, you know, it's very expensive and all of that. And we were making fun of Mecca. We're like, even if he put together all the money he has paid to school and put it together, it's a tenth of what these kids pay in a year, right?
Sure.
And Mecca, you know, and I remember we did a whole big event. And to tell you the truth, like, they had disrespected us. You know, they had this African, oh, these are just African guys that we're going to use in order for us to show our, you know, intellectual magnitude, right? So it's like, we're going to use you to show to our donors and all of these guys how really brilliant our kids are. And everyone, we were a team of four and we felt it. We knew it. And I remember I told guys, it's like, you know, the beautiful thing about being a coach is most people end up debating not for themselves, but for you, right? They want to make you proud. And I told them, I'm like, yo, usually I have the same phrase, don't make me look bad, Now, I was like, no, this time is you got to make me proud. And we went in front of a crowd of almost like, 500 American students. And they had the whole crowd just silent, listening to him. And the most beautiful thing for me was like he mastered the whole stage to a point where none of the judges were, our judges. They were all American guys.
Locals, sure.
And they won that cup.
That's awesome.
You know, they won that cup. And for me, it was like, I remember looking at him. I'm like, man, thank you. You've just given me something that it messes you up because it makes you think that things are possible,
Wow, that's the hope. Hope is an addictive drug, right?
Honestly, it is. It is. And it's one of those things where you're like, oh, man, if this can happen, imagine what things we can do.
But that's why it's so dangerous and sad when either individually or societally when we lose hope.
Honestly.
Right? Yes. Because it's that thread that holds us together in many ways.
But oh, definitely.
Thank you for both those stories. Incredible. So here you are in the US in that example, right? Now again, you've studied in the US. Now you've brought teams over to the US, you're bringing teams to universities, you're exposing the iDebate Rwanda kids to what life is here, and you're of course exposing the communities and the partnerships that you work with here. Talk about this in the broadest possible sense, right? Like what role or what benefit are these international collaborations to like kind of your long-term vision of peace building, right? So I'm in the business of, I'll say my words, you're in the business of peace building and you're in the business, as you say, of people building. So what value is the international exposure and the collaborations across borders?
I think they're in two ways. Number one is I always think that for American and all the international partners is I want to use Rwanda as an example. First, deterrence, to show them this is what happens when polarization and dehumanization take root in your societies and you have stopped engaging the other, however much however you define the other to be. And then secondly, it's also to, on the other side, to also show, well, if we are trying, man, like everybody else should be trying. Right. If we are doing the hard work, then everybody should be doing that.
Yeah.
And so that's on the aspect of peace building. But to be honest with you, Rob, one of the things that one of my aspiration has always been that I want to make sure I told like my goal is not to build the best, kids or articulate and just in Rwanda. Mine is, no, you are part of a global citizen. You're a global citizen. And because of that, it means that on every table, you need to be there. You need to be doing the work. So one of the things, for example, I tell kids is like, I'll take you to the US. And when you come here, people will undermine you. People will, because of your age, people will undermine you because you're African. They'll have pity on you. And I'm like, pity does not build relationships. That's not the kind of relationship we want. We want a mutual relationship where I bring something to the table and you bring something to the table. So, for example, I'll give you a simple example, Rob, is I respect you a lot because you have taught me so much in terms of how to think as an entrepreneur, right? But it's also, you're older than me and you have more experience than me, but I don't need pity from you because the reason to why you be tough on me is because you actually believe that, you can actually do that. And not this thing of pity, oh my gosh, it's such, no, it's like really viewing people as people.
And in fairness to your statement, right, and thank you for your kind words, but to go all the way back to the beginning of the context of our relationship, it's rooted in a mutual learning.
Yes.
Right? So, I mean, I probably, the first couple of times we talked, I probably told you, hey, sorry, selfishly, I'm going to ask you to educate me about Rwanda and where you come from and why your story and why it happened the way that it did so that I can understand things better. So then I can be more valuable to you.
Yes.
Right. So you've taught me an immense amount over the, 7-8 years we've known each other. And it has nothing to do with age, right? You're my mentor as it comes to how to use debate to shape policy and people in Rwanda. And you're my mentor in Rwanda and African policies in life. And I don't care if you're 20 years younger than I.
Yeah. And part of that for me, it's also that then I really want to see flourishing relationships, right? Flourishing relationships where beyond anything, we are all mutually learning from one another. You make the world bigger for the other. And one of the things for me that I wanted to remove in my students, and every time, you know, I'll give you an example, Rob, one of the most beautiful, every time I bring kids to the US for 3 months, they debate against different universities. And every time they leave, I always ask them the same question, what did you learn? And they always say that they are as smart as I am. And that if I do my work, if I do my work, I am as articulate and as smart as anyone else. And for me, part of it is when we have a relationship of equals, even being wrong is okay. Like it's okay actually, because that's how it is. That's relationships, right? Like we can't have it right all the time. But for me, it was this, I was tired of this low self-esteem, this inferiority complex. And that is just not rooted in how I want to see the world. And I think those international collaborations, what they allow us to see is come into my world. And I always tell kids, these people have more money than you and then all your parents combined, but they are human. They're people like you. That's it.
No, good for you. I mean, and it is, as you said earlier in relation to another question, it is the unrelenting hard slog work, right? I mean, you can't, what you've learned in your life and we all learn eventually is you can't change the world by waving a wand over the entire earth, right? We wish it was that easy. The truth is how the world changes is just a sequence of individual acts and individual conversations and individual relationships, one to one, and then two to two and group to group. It's powerful. Again, we're always, this world is always in a difficult time, no matter where we are, whether there's a peace in some part of the world, there's difficulties in other parts of the world. Right. There might have been great things going on in world parts of the world while Rwanda was undergoing the genocide that it was undergoing and people didn't even know about it. And we're living through one of those moments again where there's a particular part of the world that has elevated its conflict and we're all living through it. But I think what I hear and what I hope people take away from your lessons that you're just sharing by your life is that, you know, again, if it's possible in Rwanda to come out of the genocide that it came out of, it's literally possible anywhere.
Exactly.
And at any moment in history. But it ultimately does come down to the resolve of those people that are there, both the older generation and then my phrase now is going to be the recovery generation, right? That can make collective choices to follow your roadmap. So in that sense, your international bridge building is powerfully important for the kids that come through the program and then the people in the local communities that get exposed to your kids. But it's also just an example, which I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like that's one of the many reasons I wanted to have this conversation today is I just wanted to put this on tape, right? I wanted this to live for posterity on the internet that you're going to have shared with us the lessons that you did about how we can, how it's possible, like how there is hope. And here's the roadmap for the work that you can do and how you can use things that exist, communication, debate, right, as tools.
Yes. And one of the things that I've learned throughout the time is that, you know, the beauty of doing something for so long is a lot of your preconceived notions either get, you know, debunked or, you know, and one of the things that I found is that really real change doesn't happen when you're on stage and doing all these things that you think are very important. For me, I've noticed that real change is sometimes sitting through and listening to this kid. I'll tell you about the aspiration and you probably think, you know, nothing about life, but then you're saying, okay, I believe in you and, you know, you would do it.
That is 100% where real change happens.
That's well, like one of my mentees told me that the one thing they remember about me is that I made them feel important and I made them feel like they can do great things.
That's a gift. That's it. Like hand in the papers, you're done. Like that's the greatest gift of all time. We're going to wrap this up by empowering you to become our favorite part of the show is you become the mentor for the day. So I'm going to ask you, we've covered a ton of great things. You've shared so many both informative as well as inspirational bits of information and knowledge. But to whatever audience you want to share this knowledge with, let's come up with three pieces of great advice for our audience.
Number one is leadership is hard. but there is no better or there is no greater gift than being a leader. Number two is invest in relationships. And I think relationships are very, very important. Sometimes a lot of people talk of networking, but I always feel like that's not it. It's not, because networking is this idea of getting, and is very shallow, give you my card and all of that. No, build solid relationships and good relationships. It will help a lot. And the last part, which might sound weird, but ask for help. Like, ask for help. I think that that's the thing that I've gotten better with years, is asking for help. I have no idea. And now I'm like, I need to ask for help. And you'd be surprised at how many people are willing to help.
And I'll reverse engineer your incredibly insightful yet simple advice. If you're humble enough and self-aware enough, which is the hard part, to ask for help and build relationships with the people that you ask for it from and who give it to you, you will become a more effective leader.
Brilliant. That's it.
that's your advice. I just reversed the order.
Yeah, no. That's definitely that.
Buddy, it's incredibly simple but powerfully insightful advice that we all need to be reminded of. And I have had the good fortune to now know you for more than just a few years, and for you to say to me on my podcast that leadership is hard, that's like a, I told you it was hard. I love to see that you've come to peace with the hard parts of this, because once you come to peace with it, then literally anything is possible.
Yeah, because you told me back in 2018, you said there is no easy way to do hard things.
No, there's not. And you're doing an incredibly hard thing. I mean, like, you're doing the kinds of hard thing that most people would just shy away from and not do.
Yeah.
And yet here you are, 10 years in, incredible progress. You don't need me to tell you this, but as a friend, I couldn't be more proud of you, and I couldn't be more proud to know you. And so to have the chance to share your story here with our audience is incredibly important to me. And as I said, you know, we put this out on the internet, man, and the internet's going to live forever. So this podcast will be out there for someone to take inspiration from. And I'm grateful for that. And again, as we said in the beginning of the show, you know, hats off to our mutual friend, Dr. Steve Kernan from Pepperdine, and from All Points in Between, the ultimate entrepreneur and leader, because if not for him asking me for help way back when, and then specially pulling you out of the crowd and saying, like, I really want you to help him. Like, I know you're going to help these other young people, but I really want you to help him, because I really think you two should know each other and build a relationship. And of course, I trust Steve enough to just say, okay.
And the funny thing is that I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know that that's what he had said, but I'm glad he did.
Exactly. No, me as well. All right. So how can people find you or the organization on social media, emails, websites, whatever? How can we track you down?
On social media, I think just look for iDebate Rwanda.
Great social sites, by the way. Lots of cool, like, very beautiful photos, lots of smiling, inspired kids.
Oh, nice. Love that. And then also write me a note on LinkedIn, Jean-Michel Javineza. I'll be able to respond, but even on, you can get my email, I'll definitely respond. And so check me out on LinkedIn or even on Facebook.
Awesome. Yeah, because anybody that's listening, we have a lot of investors that listen. We have a lot of university administrators, government leaders throughout the U.S. and Latin America. Anybody that's listening that you're thinking, wow, I'd love to bring that type of a group to our campus or to our community, like, hit him up on LinkedIn, find him on social media. If you can't find him for some reason, hit me up and I'll connect you too, because that's it. We're building these bridges.
And we never really know where it goes. And we don't.
Awesome. Thanks, buddy. This is great.
Thank you.
As always, we thank you so much for listening. Today's show was recorded in Los Angeles and produced by Deanna Bernal in Mexico City. You can always find, like, follow, subscribe, and share our show via any popular podcasting platform, as well as find us on social media at Mentors Today. And if you'd like to connect with our host, you can find Rob at I Am Rob Ryan on just about any social media platform. Gracias, and thank you.